So I am very excited today to continue our current series. We've been kind of working through this summer, and we're calling it When the Bible Came Alive. Sorry, pardon me, I'm a little too tall for this. We're calling it When the Bible Came Alive. And essentially what we're doing is we've taken my life to address kind of two starting points in reaching the Bible. And we talk about on one side, we've presented these almost as like the two pitfalls of reading the Bible. I think that there is more than two, but these are two that we're holding on to. One of them is kind of like my early childhood experience, which is that the Bible should be treated with a level of respect and reverence, which I believe to be true. But for me, that level of respect and reverence for the Bible often prevented me from asking good questions. It prevented me from asking hard questions about both the Bible and also what other people were telling me about it. There's a sense of this is so holy, so revered, so important that I almost don't feel safe to be critical of things that hit me poorly. And that set me up rather poorly myself in terms of when I actually began to engage the Bible more seriously. I realized I wasn't feeling really equipped to wrestle with some of the more challenging things I came across. And then that led me to my early adulthood, which was a place of, I just don't think this actually speaks to my life in a helpful way at all. I think it's antiquated. And so I dismissed it as a helpful part of my life. And so for this series, we're kind of trying to navigate what I have actually discovered since then, which is a middle ground, a thoughtful and informed engagement with the Bible that allows it to come alive. It's almost a process of keeping the baby in the bath and getting rid of some of that bathwater. And so what we've tried to do here is talk about how the Bible has become what it is to me today, an incredibly invaluable tool to connect with other people, to connect with God, to understand my place in this world, and to bring me outside of myself in a way that I so often need help doing. And so, if you want to hear even more about that, feel free to go back to one of my first two sermons. I kind of tell my story a little bit more in depth and how I arrived there. But what we want to do is dive into the very moments, the thoughts, the experiences, the concepts, the things that we've come across in our life that has helped the Bible come alive. And so I've shared some things about my experience of understanding the role of culture. I've shared my experience of our understanding of how we can read the Bible and actually honor what it's trying to say and not pretend that every word is being written to me right here in this space. And we've talked about today something else that I want to touch on, which is something I referenced in my first talk. And I was talking about culture, and one of the things that I kind of referenced in passing was that the Bible is a collection of many different genres. I remember when I first became aware of genre, like I was aware of it in terms of like literature, like you have nonfiction and fiction and historical fiction and biography, and I was aware of these things in my life, but I remember the first time I had a professor bring up to me the reality that this is true of the Bible as well, that there is different genres written within the Bible because it's a collection of writings written over hundreds of years trying to do different things and actually written in different ways. And I remember I had this professor that really fleshed out the implication of this for me, that it isn't just one long, continuous piece of writing. You know, you have narratives, you have poetry, you have wisdom sayings, you have parables, you have biographies, you have letters, you have prophetic sayings. And he began to draw out the implications of how we read these things. And he pointed to, in his opinion, how a lot of our kind of more unfortunate misinterpretations of the Bible, he pointed back to an unawareness of genre, that we were reading something as if it was written in a different way. For example, we would read something that is poetry, taking analogies that are commonplace in poetry, or imagery that's very commonplace in prophetic writings, and reading them like it was just common prose, talking about how something literally is. You know, and as a kid who grew up going to church, very involved, I think I take the Bible very seriously, and I would even say that I take it literally. But what I begin to think is taking it literally in my mind was some way of saying that I read every line like it was a statement I was saying to you. And it was in this class that I realized that that wasn't even honoring what the Bible was. If I'm reading poetry like it is a New York Times piece, I'm doing something wrong. I'm not honoring the author. And so when he began to walk us through the implications of genre and introduce to us what genre, he started with the beginning, as in the book of Genesis. And what he did is he talked about how even parts of the book of Genesis are different from the rest. That actually the first 11 chapters of Genesis, chapters 1 through 11, are written in a different genre than the 12 chapters on. That there's different words used, there's different types of language used, that the actual genre was something different. I think this is crazy. I remember it blew my mind. It's like, I just thought it was the book of Genesis. Like, I didn't really think there or have the tools to look at how the first 11 chapters would have been different. But what I come to see is likely the difference in these first 11 chapters, when it was originally consumed by its readers, would have felt obvious. Like, so much so that there was no need to, like, clarify. They didn't need to draw attention to it. It just would have been clear when you were reading it that the language was different. It would be almost like if we were reading a book today and you saw an author, like, italicize a section as it's quoting something else. You would just know that that was something different. Because once I saw this, once I realized that the first 11 chapters of Genesis had a very distinctly different genre than the rest of it, it felt so true to me. Like, the style is different, the kinds of words that are using it. Like, the whole feel of those first 11 chapters feel different than the rest. You know, his professor said, if this book was compiled today, if somebody was writing Genesis in the style that we write Genesis today, that perhaps the way you could think of the first 11 chapters would be like a preface, or perhaps like a prologue. That it's almost like setting the stage through the lens which we can understand the story that's about to unfold in Genesis and then the Bible at whole. You know, I was almost thinking about, like, obviously we read stories and they'll have a little preface of, like, you know, Lord of the Rings will, like, set up the world you're about to go into. Or, like, I like Game of Thrones and, like, the opening scene, like, zooms in and you actually get to, like, see the map of what's happening. It's like setting the context for where things are going here. And those first 11 chapters of Genesis actually fall into a type of genre that's actually fairly common in the ancient world. The original readers would have recognized what this was. And it's what we might call epic poetic narrative. Whereas from Genesis on, and Genesis 12 starts with the story of Abraham and his descendants, that would read much more straightforward, like an ancient narrative, which is still a little different than what we understand as a narrative today in modern writings. But these first 11 chapters are something distinctly different. You know, the goal of epic poetic narratives is to help people, or in this case, the ancient Jewish people, likely during a time when they were exiled and oppressed under foreign rule, understand who we are. So the questions, what an epic poetic tries to do, is it asks, who are we? Who are we in relationship to each other, to God, to the world? Like, what does it mean to be human? You know, in a way, as much as it's telling a story of specific people, like Adam, Eve, Cain, Abel, Noah, to name some of the names we might be familiar with and from Genesis 1 through 11, it's trying to tell the story of all of us. You know, I think we still do this in some ways today. Like, we ask these big questions. Who are we? How do I relate to other people? How do I relate to God? How do I relate to the world? What does it mean to be a human? You know, I think we do this today, but we do it through philosophy or through satire or through, like, narratives of film or TV or through things like we just watched, like TED Talks. We still do ask these questions as a society, but we just don't really use the epic poetic narrative genre anymore. It's not a commonplace part of who we are in the way that it was at the time it was written. And so I want to zoom in here, and I want to start us off in the beginning. And I want to read and look at what we see here from Genesis. So I'm going to read, for the sake of the length, because this is all of chapter 1 and part of chapter 2, I'm going to do some summarizing and some reading of the passage. So starting in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. God saw that light was good. And then to summarize, he creates day and night on the second day, and water and sky, and he calls it good. And then the third day, he divides the land and the sea, and then creates all the vegetation, and he calls it all good. And then on the fourth day, he creates the moon, the stars, the sun, and he calls it good. And then on the fifth day, he creates all the animals of the sea and the birds of the sky, and he blesses them, tells them to go fill the whole earth, and then calls them all good. He then creates the domesticated land animals and the wild animals and calls them both good. And then picking back up in verse 26, then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creation that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. He then tells the humans to fill the earth, to care for it, to rule over it. Or what I actually think is probably the better translation or understanding of this would be to be stewards of the earth. And then he again calls all of them good. All of humanity good. Male and female good. Picking back up in verse 31, he said, God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and morning on the sixth day. And then on the seventh day, God looks at all that he created, and he blesses it and makes that seventh day holy because he rested from all the work that he had done. So again, this was written to address the questions of who are we? How do we relate to each other? God, the world. And I think reading this stuff, there's just some super helpful things that immediately jump out to me. However, below the surface, I think that there's actually even more for us. As I mentioned earlier, epic poetic narratives were actually kind of a commonplace thing in the ancient world. We actually know a lot about this genre of writing. And the meaning in these passages, I think, explode to life when you compare them to the other epic poetic narratives in the ancient world. It's almost like it speaks powerfully on its own, but in comparison to what the other narratives were saying, it speaks even more powerfully of how we understand who we are in relation to each other, God, and the world. You see, in the other epic poetic narratives in the ancient world, I would say probably the most well-known one is the Mesopotamian Epic of Gilgamesh. We have a very different picture. It's true in this one, but it's also true in the other ones we come across. We have a picture of humans who work for the gods. There's a very contentious relationship between God and humanity. You know, gods are often like portrayed as being selfish and usually tricking humanity into doing things for the gods' benefit. You know, the who are we question, especially in relationship to other people and gods, like those stories usually paint a picture of like you're in it for yourself. You're working on your own purposes, usually at odds to other people's purposes and God's purposes. And often humanity and gods, they have like selfish desires that almost have to be pursued at the other's expense. And I think it's reading Genesis in the context of these other epic poetic narratives that it more powerfully jumps off the page. It's almost like Genesis draws this out so powerfully in contrast. Rather than seeing a picture of a contentious, adversarial relationship between each other and God, Genesis shows something different. First off, we see a picture of a God who is good, and all of creation that is good. Man and women are made with God's image. They have the divine within them, and they are good. I mean, the implications of that, if you think about an early, tribal, violent society, you think about what it means to say every man and woman is good and created in God's image. You think about what it means to say that. It's powerful. We also see a God that doesn't have need. He's the creator of everything. And rather, he seems to be creating this, like, working on humanity's behalf. He's loving, he's providing for them. And I love on the stuff that he even builds rest in. It's like, have you ever had a boss that just doesn't understand that you're a human being? Like, God was like, you know what? You need to take a break, guys. Like, it's chill. Like, this isn't all about work. That is meaningful. It's not a contentious relationship, but one of love. God loves us. And even more than that, we're created to love each other because we are all made in God's image and we are good. The ideal reality God creates is one where we lived in perfect harmony and connection with God, perfect harmony and connection with each other, and perfect harmony and connection with the world itself. Where God is the good and trustworthy provider of our needs, the one who facilitates open and perfect connection between him and each other. You know, look at how this hits us when we read it in the correct genre, when we ask the questions that this genre is trying to ask. I think it's deep and beautiful, right? But for much of my early life, I read Genesis 1 through 11 like I read a history book in school. And I ask the same questions I ask of a history book. I ask, you know, what happened? In what order? Who started what? Who's to blame? What are the causes? And when I read Genesis that way, I mean, it was a hard experience for me. Not only did it make something like science feel like a threat to my belief in God, like I always got caught up on this. There was light and darkness days before God created the sun. Like, it just didn't understand that. But more than that, actually, when I read through all of this, it actually made me feel like God was a little bit unsafe. You know, I think about what comes right after this, Genesis, second half of Genesis 2 and 3. It's the story of Adam and Eve. You know, when I read that, asking the questions I ask of a history book, I felt like God was kind of manipulative and arbitrary. That I can have this perfect life as long as I don't eat from this one tree that without explanation, I just can't eat from. And to me, I always struggled personally about how I felt like God set them up for failure and then punished them when they failed. It's like, this is the most delicious bowl of ice cream in the entire world. It is everything you want, but you just can't have it. And I'm going to put it on just out here in front of you, and I'm going to go out for a while. And I'm going to create this serpent, because I created everything. And this serpent is just going to nonstop talk to you about how amazing this is and how it doesn't make sense that I don't want you to eat this. And of course, I really want you to eat this, and I'm testing you to eat this ice cream. And the serpent's sitting there. And then when I do eat ice cream, God's like, not only you, but every person forever is punished. Like, it felt arbitrary. It felt like I really did not enjoy the emotions around that for me. I often just tried to ignore this. This was part of the things when I talk about my early adulthood where I was like, yeah, I just don't know if I can take the Bible seriously. But as I begin to understand the role of genre and I begin to understand the role of specifically epic poetic narratives, my questions changed. You know, there may have been a literal Adam and Eve. I absolutely believe that could be true. But that is 100% not the point of what Genesis 1 through 3 is trying to say. It isn't trying to answer the questions of what happened in what order, who started what, and what was at fault. It is trying to answer the questions that an epic poetic narrative is trying to answer. It is trying to help people understand who they are. Who are you? What does it mean to be you? What does it mean to relate to these other people, especially in a violent world? What does it mean to relate to a God when you experience suffering? What does it mean to think about the world around you when you don't have the infrastructures in place to save you from natural disasters? How do you relate to all of these things? And then the story helped me see the very nature of what so often leads to our hurt. When I looked at Adam and Eve through this light, I was like, that feels so true. That hurt and suffering so often happen when we eat of the tree of knowledge and good and evil, when we decide, I will be the arbiter of what is right and wrong. I will be the judge of the world. I will be the one in control. I won't eat of the tree of life, which is everything I could ever need, and instead I will eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then the evil one will be pushing me that way, telling me narratives that make sense to me. Oh, of course, you would be a better boss. Of course, your opinion is the right one. And then on top of this, when I think about what it means to be human, it is just so helpful. Instead of it being an adversarial relationship, God is aligned with humanity. There's a God who longs to comfort, provide. He offers us grace and healing and acceptance. And what is totally absent in the other epic poetic narratives, we see the craziness of life, the hurt, the brokenness. It's not something God is doing to us. It's what we so often do to ourselves. And in the midst of that, all the while, he is bringing order and light to what is formless, empty, and dark. And all of this, it just unlocked a sense of understanding. The sense of being aware of what the genre was and asking the questions that genre is trying to address. I'm not going to poetry and asking poetry, like, what does this person look like? They look like a river running through a forest? That makes no sense to me. I'm asking the questions it's trying to answer. You know, I think this is just, it's just one case study here. It's just of what the genre is and what it means to ask the right questions of it for me personally, and how it took something that presented a point of crisis to me and instead made it something that came alive with meaning and informs my everyday life. And if you're interested in this, if you were like, hey, that sounds intriguing to me, I often have questions about what the Bible's really trying to say, the tool that I almost always give out is a book. It's called How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth by Gordon Fee and Douglas Stewart. It's a really straightforward, helpful tool. It's also like it's broken into sections. And so if you're like, I would like to read Genesis, you don't necessarily have to read the whole book. You can start off on what it says about Genesis. And the reason I lie, it's just kind of not overly academic, but it really hits on big concepts that helps me as a person with a limited mind frame that grew up in a very specific context, asking very specific questions, to take a step back and say, what is this trying to communicate? And then after I've asked the question, say, so in respect with what this is trying to communicate, what does it mean for me? And, you know, and what I'd like to do is, I think it was an interesting case study of how honoring genre to me opened up my mind and my experience of the Bible being something that I actually find to be almost across the board. Every time I go to it, there's something I can find that is helpful and meaningful. It comes alive to me. It helps me connect with the people in my life. It helps me connect with God. It helps me think about a world that feels overwhelming to me. In a lot of ways, it humbles me because I recognize that my story is this small thing, but at the same time, it uplifts me because it tells me, even though I'm small, God sees me and loves me. But on top of what genre can help us to do, I actually just say, what Genesis is communicating to us is amazing, and often I struggle to believe it's true. That God is good, reliably good. That the world around us and everything from the birds and trees are good. That humanity is good, and that each of us lives a divine image, a reflection of God. And strangely enough, in my life, I know many people who've had experiences of the Bible, I think used inappropriately, that actually make you question that. Is God really good? Or even somehow provoke you to demean and think less of other people. This is the prologue. This is the lens in which we see the Bible. Before we jump into anything else, we got to start with, everybody's created in God's image. Every one of us is loved and cared for and seen as good. Creation, seen as good. Man, woman, the origin of who we are, every background, seen as good. Now let's go and start interpreting things. And my experience is that so often the arbitrariness of God that has felt like a question to me in life at times, or the question of if there is a God, how is there suffering? Is it somehow like he's doing this to me? The truth and reliability of his goodness feels at stake. And so in those moments, I will often return to Genesis. And I will say, before anything was not ideal, what is the perfected reality? So I can kind of center myself for a little bit. How do I think about God? I go back to Genesis and I'm like, dude, he loves me. He created me. He thinks I am good. He wants me to relate to other human beings as good. He wants me to relate to creation and the world as good. I have a responsibility to be a steward over all of this. A sermon for another time when we look at Cain and Abel. I am my brother's keeper. I do have responsibility to other people. And I start there, and it feels centering to me. And what I'd like to do is to pray for us here in a second. And I want to pray for anybody that's interested that the grounding of what I see Genesis 1 through 11 answering the questions of a good God who loves us and intends good for us, longs for us to embrace the diversity of our world, to fill the world, multiply, to go out, be different people, but see all of us through the image of him. I pray that that would feel accessible for us this week. And like that can feel big picture, but even just in the sense of like with my coworker this week, when I feel like they are being a total jerk, or when I feel small this week, what does that look like to embrace this reality? And so if everyone wants to stand with me, I'm going to pray. If you would like to join along in your head, please feel free to do so. Jesus, thank you so much. Thank you for the joys of life. And I pray right now. So I used to really love poetry, and I love the way that it speaks to me and connects with me on a way that kind of bypasses my brain. And I love the kind of repetition of this opening passage of there was day and there was night. There was morning, there was evening. And God saw it all, and it was good. And I just pray for me and for all of us here as we experience inevitable struggle, when we experience inevitable anxiety, when we question ourselves or find ourselves positioning ourselves or feeling positioned as enemy to other people, we could find there to be a morning and a night and then a new day where we discover your goodness anew. And this sense of being stewards of this world would feel helpful, would feel like, hey, I'm a steward in your image. I'm reflecting you in how I relate to other people in the world around me. And so I just pray that that would feel empowering this week. That you are in the image of God and are empowered to be his steward on earth. And for many of us that think that seventh day is a joke, rest? Are you kidding me? I pray, Jesus, that you would speak rest into our lives right now. It's not us being lazy or failing to meet expectations, but embracing a desire you have for us, which is to sit back and enjoy the things that are created.